Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our conversation continues with Robert Doerr, Commissioner of the New York City Human Resources Administration. Also joining us in our conversation from IBM is Stu Advinsky. Robert, with a dramatic fall in city revenue and even a more troubling revenue picture at the state level, they've required a series of spending reductions for all programs. Would you elaborate on how you've approached doing more with less and meeting these reduction targets?
Well, in the past, leading up to what we're about to experience in the coming months, we were able to meet our targets two ways, principally. One, we continued to enforce the work requirements in cash assistance, and so our need for cash welfare coming from the public dollar was less. And so we achieved some of our goals just by doing our program well. In addition, we were able to reduce our what we call our budgeted headcount. In other words, we had our agency was budgeted up to a certain amount, but we never got to there. And so we were able to eliminate some unfilled positions. So that was relatively easy because there's no pain with that. Now we're really getting close to the tough times, and we're going to have to look at some harder things going forward. But my goal will be to avoid any cuts to frontline staff, people that actually see clients and work with people who are in need of benefits. And also it will be to defend our agency because we're the ones who get more business during bad times, not less. And so we'll advocate with the mayor that maybe an across-the-board cut, including us, isn't exactly the right approach. Maybe we should be excused of that. That may not be successful. But our goal is going to be to not give in on our focus on work and employment, to do what we can on fraud and waste, particularly in the Medicaid program, where I think there's some savings to be had, and to find savings in sort of middle management and above, as opposed to frontline workers.
At the federal level, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act provided additional funding to the tune of $4 billion to the city. To what extent are any of your programs leveraging this funding?
The food stamp program got an increase in the grant amount. And so that was like very quickly out the door to recipients. When I testified before the city council, I said this may be the first real money that came from the stimulus package. There was some other additional administrative benefits that came to us through the state that allowed us to shore up some gaps and to sort of avoid further cuts. And then there is some additional money in what's called the Temporary Assistance for Needy Family Block Grant Fund. And we've accessed some of that to create transitional jobs programs so people can actually get paid work through programs that we've set up. Probably create about 2,500 jobs like that from that money between now and next September. Those were the three principal.
So for those funds, how are you tracking and reporting on those funds?
Well, we track the number of transitional jobs very closely. We are monitoring that along with the state because the money came through the state as well, and we track that. We don't track much on food stamps because it's just a benefit that went out the door and goes out every month. And we have some responsibilities to account for our spending and food stamp administration there. But the number one tracking ingredient is going to be the number of paid work, transitional jobs, real jobs that we create, whether it's in city government or in the private sector, or that our partners help create and then we fund.
Following up on that, the employment-focused programs are a key component in Mayor Bloomberg's economic recovery plan. Will you tell us more about HRA's efforts in this area and more specifically about the job training participant model?
The transitional jobs is a continuation of something we call JTP, or Job Training Partnership Program, where we provide jobs to people who are recipients of cash assistance. We get them off of cash assistance. They work 4 days and they have 1 day of training, principally in the parks department. And if you go to the New York City parks system at any time, you'll see what we call JTP employees doing various jobs in the parks department, whether it's maintenance or cleanup or a collection of refuse or a whole number of things. And that's one of our most successful programs. It's a real wage. It comes with benefits. They're part of the city's operation. The only drawback is that it's 6 to 9 months. And at the end of that point, the theory is, and the goal is, and we've had some success with this, is that they're ready to be placed into permanent employment and to find a permanent employment job, whether it's in the parks or somewhere else. We have a better rate at getting them into permanent employment than we have in some other programs, but it's still tough, and it'll be tougher in the coming years. So that's what we've done in the past. It is important to recognize, though, that even that well-developed program is 4,500 people. At its peak. You add the 2,500 in this very, and these are expensive programs, by the way, that we do as a result of the stimulus package. And so that's 7,000 people or something like that. Well, we have 355,000 recipients of cash assistance. Now, that includes kids. But there's no way a transitional jobs program by itself or a jobs program by itself can fill the gap that's caused by a really, really weak economy. And I think there is some concern that, that people think that that's the answer. It is not the answer. It cannot possibly be the answer because there isn't the money to pay for it. And the numbers just, it just can't be built to scale. We're never going to have 100,000 JTPs in New York City. What we need, more than 100,000 entry-level jobs in New York City. And we need them available all the time, constantly turning over. And that comes from the global greater economy. And so transitional jobs play a role, and they're important, but they cannot replace the provision of jobs through the greater economy.
Shifting gears a bit, expanding access to such programs as Medicaid, you know, should be, also be accompanied by necessary safeguards. Would you tell us about your efforts to combat waste, fraud, and abuse in the Medicaid program?
We first of all, we have an application process, and we do some data matches with various information databases involving resources and income to see if we find hits that people have misled us about their income, and then we pursue that. We about once a quarter, you'll see a story in the paper where the district attorney for one of the district attorneys in the city of New York has, you know, busted 10 people or 20 people for abusing the Medicaid program by getting the benefits of Medicaid while also owning 3 houses and 2 cars. It does happen. And that those came from our investigations. So we have an investigation unit that has a good relationship with district attorney's offices, and we do that. We also have a unit that does work on providers because we're not going to save Medicaid dollars by stopping people that are fraudulently getting the Medicaid card. We really can reduce Medicaid costs if we can make sure that people that provide healthcare services, transportation services, medical device services, pharmaceutical services, or just regular doctor's visits are billing correctly. And for a long time in the state of New York, there was very little effort in that regard. And as a result, I think some healthcare providers got in some very bad habits with regard to documentation and submitting bills that maybe were goosed a little bit. And so we're now using databases, some of which are the using of technology, to review billings from various providers. And when we see anomalies where, you know, somebody was billing for X 1 month and 3 months later they're 3 times X, we'll go in and audit them and see that they are really billing for the genuine services. And that's resulted in some findings. It's very hard to get a recovery from that, but we can send a message to these providers that if they are going to abuse the system, they're going to be audited and they're going to be brought into a review process and they maybe face very severe penalties and payback requirements. That, I think, at our level has had some effect. I think the state is doing it as well. And I'm hoping that they're having some effect. But I should say, everyone who knows anything about the Medicaid program should know that, that New York State spends a great deal on Medicaid, more than any other state. Mayor Bloomberg has wanted us to be contributors to reducing that disproportionate situation. I think at HRA we have been. But by and large, the and I don't want to sound like I'm passing the buck here, responsibility for policing providers of health care is at the state level, and the state of New York has to do that. And I think they've had some success, but they need to have more.
I actually wanted to talk about the working relationship with other city social services agencies, such as the Department of Homeless Services. How do you coordinate with all the other social services agencies?
That's probably the hardest job, I think, in many respects, of how do you work well with your colleagues in on a single case, because we all are very focused on our primary mission. But in homeless services, we actually have a very good partnership with Commissioner Hess and his people. We provide sometimes the benefits that allow people to remain outside of the shelter system. We provide the employment program that helps them get into work so that they can earn a living so they can afford to live outside of the shelter system or to receive a subsidy, because some of our housing subsidies for post-shelter residents are dependent on a job. So we do that. We provide child support enforcement services to single moms in the shelter system. We provide domestic violence services to people who are either in the shelter system or should be in our shelter system instead of theirs. We meet on a biweekly basis at City Hall in a big round room with the deputy mayor, and you never know, the mayor could pop in and start yelling at us at any given moment. We are forced to work together. And often what it boils down to is making sure that my staff knows, too, that if there is an issue with another agency, that they can't resolve, that they bring it to my attention so that I can help get it resolved. And similarly, the same thing on Commissioner Hess's side. And I think we both do that. And we're very understanding of that. I expect him to call me with problems in my agency, and I expect to call him occasionally with problems in his agency. And that's the way the world works. And being willing to do that and being okay with doing that and not making it a tension convention every time you do that is really helpful. And the same thing for John Mattingly, who's the commissioner of the Administration for Children's Services that does foster care and adoption and child care. We're on the phone all the time, and sometimes it's my problem and sometimes it's his problem, but we're working them out.
So switching gears a little bit and taking the focus away from the internal collaboration with city agencies, what about external collaboration? What I mean by that is, what kinds of public-private partnerships are you engaged in?
Well, we certainly are very dependent on our various private sector partners, or where we are the customer. We have, in the technology business, we have many people that provide us services. We have certain vendors of ours are not-for-profit or for-profit entities that are that we pay a significant amount of money for them to provide a service for us. We monitor them in the same way that we do monitor our own offices. We have a vendor stat and job stat, which are meetings where we go over the data. Are you delivering what you said you were going to deliver? And is it appropriate? And what are the problems? So we're very dependent on that. The unfortunate part is that in developing a contract that is outcome-based and pays for deliverables takes so long in New York City. There's a long ramp up to that, and we really need to work better at allowing people in my position to be more flexible in picking our vendors and discharging our vendors and enforcing requirements and also rewarding for success. I suppose appropriate concern about political influences has really tied us in knots. And so that it's very hard for me to see a provider who's doing a great job, for instance, providing real work for guys and effective substance abuse treatment, placement rate and permanent employment that's excellent, plus shelter. You know, I know providers like that. I would like to go to them and say, here's a bunch of money. I'm going to monitor you and make sure you do your job, and let's go to work. But I can't make a decision like that because of the contracting requirements, whether it's from the federal government or the state or the city rules that prevent me from making judgments like that because of the potential abuse that might happen if I did it because he was my friend or he was a political supporter of the mayor. And so that's a problem. So our ramp-up period to get somebody on board and to be effective and helpful to us takes a long time, and there's a lot of process.
Circling back to one of the topics earlier, you told us about your career path from OTDA to HRA. Along that path, you moved from leading the agency that set program policy to leading the agency, the largest agency, implementing those policies. How has that changed your perspective on human services and the way they should be delivered?
I was pretty hands-off and supportive of the local administrators of the program even when I was at the state. But I probably feel that way even stronger now. I do, one of the lines in social services that sometimes you'll hear is that of all the players in social services, the people that are most interested in talking about personal responsibility and the importance of work are the frontline workers in the social services agencies, the women and men who actually see clients every day. And that's definitely true in New York City. If I'm under some criticism from outside advocacy groups about work requirements or something, and I'm feeling beleaguered by that, if I just go and talk to my frontline workers, they say, these people can work, they want to work, they should work, we need to enforce the rules. There's a lot of people in the world who think government can solve everybody's problem. And there's a lot of them. And we all know who they are. And it's not true. People need to solve their own problems. And not entirely. We can help. We can be supportive. But there is a role for personal responsibility. And so I like my work. I think my workers do a great job. But I also know that they can only do so much. They can help people, but they can't solve everything. And government really can't solve every problem that people face.
What does the future hold for New York City's Human Resources Administration? We will ask Robert Doerr, its commissioner, when the conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.